environmentalists and geologists and archaeologists were all descending on the Gobi in the 19th and early 20th century. I guess my own experiences and my own small biographical story of extraction and community making and reparation and healing and knowledge making just all sort of started tumbling together. I've been working for a long time in the social history of knowledge in Inner Asian Buddhist life, meaning not just a straight intellectual history, but thinking about conditions of knowledge and knowledge practices also, as much as those can be reconstructed, especially from the 18th and 19th and early 20th centuries in the frontiers of Tibet and Mongolia and the Qing and increasingly with Europe. Looking at circulations of knowledge. And many of the sources I've been reading are from the perspective of Buddhist monks in Tibet and Mongolia who are needing to account for different conceptualizations of the world, including things like we would call nature, geography and cartography, and in some cases also the human biomedical models and so on. And what that forced me to think about over time is the ways that when these authors are writing about environments, they're also in the same breath writing about minds and perception, and how recent debates in the environmental humanities, and I think the medical humanities a little bit too, around so-called nature-culture binaries, the historical specificity of our notion of the human, capital H human, and so on, really fail to account for those sources. And in fact, enacts epistemic erasure when we use those terms to describe them.
You're listening to Buddhist Studies Footnotes, and I'm Frances Garrett. Today, I'm speaking with Matt King, a professor of Buddhist Studies at the University of California, Riverside. He's also the director of Asian Studies there and co-director of the Medical Humanities Program at UCR. Matt's research traces encounters between Buddhist scholasticism, science, humanism, and state socialism in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Outside of research and teaching, Matt works with permaculture at his home in Southern California, including native plant gardening, chicken raising, and water-wise landscaping. In this conversation, part of a footnote series on post-humanist approaches to the study of Buddhism, Matt talks about his new research on the Gobi Desert in the long 19th century. He begins this work with a question that troubled Buddhist monks and scientists alike. As he puts it, why was a dry sea basin full of fossilized aquatic life to be found sprawling across high Asia? As he works to avoid reproducing binary thinking like nature, culture, or religion science, Matt looks at the desert as a lens for rescaling the human in time, place, and community. Windswept, a tangle of teeth, stone, bone, and sedimented life. The Gobi Desert, Matt writes, has long been a membrane of past and present.
In the two projects I'm really focused on now, which are forcing me to really read the incredible literature, not only on posthumanism, but also feminist critiques of science, has been really, really important. And new materialism, also indigenous knowledge, indigenous science, are helping me really think about the stakes of those inner Asian authors as they wrote about different accounts of the world, of the shape of the earth, about the closure principle of a completely material person, about the brain. It's kind of led me to want to think about what could be a very radical environmental humanities in finding work by scholars like Anna Singh, and also reading Deleuze and Guattari and others, organic thinkers and organic modelers of the social, and also some really important work on the aquatic spaces of mobility and contact, like the Mediterranean and the Black Atlantic, really made me think about the sorts of environments that the figures who my work explores and who I've also had the opportunity to stand in over the years in doing this research, especially the desert sort of inland deserts of Asia, the Gobi Desert and adjacent sort of deserts, how that is not only an object of culture, but is itself a protagonist and a material agent. I've had the opportunity to spend altogether probably about a year traveling around with Gobi monks, spending time with Gobi peoples, touching Gobi places, you know, rubbing up against Gobi mountains, going to Gobi pilgrimage spots, all the way down to the edges of what we might consider the Gobi in places like Dinhuang and Gansu and all that more recently. So on a personal level too, I thought these are environments that I've had the luck to dip my toe in and spend a little bit of time in. And the authors who I have been reading, the inner Asian authors, themselves lived in or crossed over or tried to account for in various ways. So I was motivated in this new project to think about what could be a radical type of environmental history in Buddhist studies or in the social history of knowledge in that area generally. What would that look like? How far can we go? Is my challenge in attributing, I would say, well, making the Gobi a protagonist and not simply an object of the story.
We have so many things in common, and that was a lot of amazing material that you just summarized, and I'd love to get into a bunch of that. But to back up a little bit, when you talk about Inner Asia, can you describe what that space is?
Yeah. Speaking of geographies of imagination, when I say that, I can more specifically say I'm interested in the frontiers and the zones of exchange between Tibetan and Mongolian communities, and specifically between literate monks, what I call scholastics, who were linked together, though they were divided by many other things like administrative regions and language and political zones and all the rest, by a shared network of monastic colleges, a pedagogical and an intellectual network that extended from central Tibet and the Himalayan foothills. By the time that I'm thinking in the 18th and 19th century, early 20th century, to Russia, to the heartland of the Qing and then of the Republic in China, I'm interested in thinking about these as not coherent or homogeneous intellectual spaces, but as sites of exchange and of writing and of interpreting that are widely understudied. I think that, you know, I consider that network of monastic colleges in which we find monks from Tibet and Mongolia and so on. I mean, this is probably the most dispersed recipient of socialism in the 20th century, for example, and of these revolutionary modern projects, very early ones in Asian history anyways, and also really important and widely understudied sites for thinking about circulations of natural philosophy, humanities from Europe, of medicine and of cartography and of mathematics, and also, of course, repositories for thinking about the global imaginations and projects of the Qing, especially, which I've also in some other work really have tried to center as being very important for what we call Asian studies in the North Atlantic Academy. So when I say Inner Asia, I'm thinking about a particular class of actors who happily left abundant written artifacts about their life and their intellectual projects, as well as their aesthetic and other sorts of projects. And these include ethnic communities we would today call Mongolians and Tibetans, although, of course, that's a pretty ahistoric designation. So very broadly, Asia's heartland, and really at the center of that are big desert spaces, which is really leading me back to one of these projects now that I think has some bearing upon post-humanism.
Yeah, so that's a really nuanced answer to what someone might just give a geographical answer to. So you're talking about Mongolia and Western China and Tibetan regions and former Soviet states, Siberia and regions of Russia, but then also transmission to South Asia and to Europe. And so you're not really thinking of our concurrent geographic borders, but of course, at different moments in different histories of these kind of flows or circulations of knowledge and people and cultures.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And within that flow, how individual actors at different times were themselves producing spatial and temporal and community imaginaries, in part through interacting with landscape, among many other resources.
So that brings me to another question I wanted to zoom back out on, which is this idea of nature that you talked about a few seconds ago. So in some of your work, you talk about the idea of nature being unknown in pre-modern Buddhist sources from Inner Asia. But before we get to that, could you give us an overview of what you mean by that? What is this idea of nature that you're referring to in that context? And why is it important for us to think more critically about that concept?
I think the interesting intervention for those of us working in, say, Buddhist studies or Inner Asian cultural history and so on, is to think about actually what is the shadow of nature, which is culture, and the human is actually what is drawing lines around the semantic and conceptual definitions of nature that we find if we do the genealogy of these concepts in their context of use through the Renaissance and Enlightenment, and certainly through the Industrial Revolution and the global capital market and so on. I tend to think of nature in that context as, in light of Michel Trouillot's notions of languages of geographies of naming and geographies of command, because nature is not just a neutral designation for what is apart from the human, but it is also an object, a sovereign object for the human. And so nature is basically, nature is just what is, whereas it's like the outside, whereas the human is the inside full of intentionality, thought, motivation, civilization, culture. And then you know, there's traditions around nature as being the object of symbolic thought and human classification. But I think that what's really motivating me is some kind of exciting critical project is actually more recent work by Catherine Yusof on the tradition of Black criticism of the sciences, also a feminist one and a decolonial one, but very particularly Black criticism of what appears to be very neutral and transparent technical fields about nature, right? Like geology in her work. And that intervention is that human-inhuman distinctions appear natural, but are never so. And in fact are, as with the nature concept, modern concepts of power, power-laden modern concepts, and they are sovereign and imperial ones. But when we really look at the moral and ideological weight, the weightedness of the category of nature in relationship to the human, that I don't think we find. And I think that's one of the important reasons for trying to think about this kind of project, because this turn to the accounting for the crisis of the Anthropocene, one of those has been about what is the place of the humanities and even the notion of the human when human culture distinctions no longer obtain. That's the definition of the Anthropocene. I think there's an opportunity for Buddhist studies, as there is for the vast, very rich field of indigenous studies and indigenous traditions and feminist critiques of science, to be bringing in relational, embodied, multivalent, immanent. And I actually find that in my own work, even in European tradition, Alexander von Humboldt, for example, who gives us the modern notion of ecology and nature in his work. He has this concept of Ansichtskunde in German, which can mean looking or regarding nature, but actually he's using nature as a way of regarding, a way of looking. That's this notion of that concept in the 19th century. And I think that that's really more of the flavor of what I'm finding in the Inner Asian sources that I'm exploring. And I think there's like really, really important things there. I'm really motivated to think a lot about it.
Yeah, so we find strains of these other types of orientations even in European history with von Humboldt. So that's really interesting. Just to get specific about some examples, in some of the work you shared with me, you write about the Tibetan Buddhist terms Nögi Jigten, which you translate as the world of the vessel, and Chögi Jigten, which you translate as the world of the contents. And I wonder if you could spell those out for people listening. Because you tie those to how sentient lives and environments are co-constructed, human beings or other sentient life and environments, what we might otherwise call nature, are co-constructed and, as you were just saying now, fundamentally perspectival. So could you walk us through that argument and how it helps us think differently about this nature-culture binary that so many of us are embedded in?
Yeah, in which I am too, of course. Well, so that those two distinctions, the world of the vessel, firstly, something like environments, and then the world of the contents by which these authors tend to mean sentient life specifically, and certainly not exclusively human life, are ways of writing and thinking about rubrics for describing the world. Because of my own interest in frontiers and exchanges and borderlands, I find early examples of this in the writing of Tibetans who were called to the courts of the Mongol Empire in the 13th century, Tsogyo Gyalpa, and some others who were made into preceptors and teachers for the Mongol court, basically for the grandsons and great-grandsons of Chinggis Khan and of Kublai Khan and so on. So these figures, as they are interested in presenting the Buddhist tradition, Buddhist knowledge and all the rest, preface by accounts of the genesis of the world or the generation and development of the world and its material and epistemic conditions. They're writing in great detail about particles and atoms and elemental entanglements and then also modes of perception and authoritative types of knowledge practices, which are already all entangled and by which beings know the world from different embodied perspectives. I find an emphasis on prefacing presentations of Buddhist knowledge with this turn to planetary thinking when there are cross-cultural exchanges. So the 13th century Mongol Empire is one. We jump forward to the 16th century when there's a new wave of Tibet-Mongolia interaction, Tibetan and Mongolian interaction. Suddenly these historical texts and biographical texts are spending quite a bit of time explaining the genesis of the world, the development of the world. And then definitely in the Qing, as these inner Asian monks are employed into the grand sovereign projects of the Qing, arranging polylingual, polyethnic models of universal sovereignty, encyclopedia projects, cartographic projects, translation manuals, and all these kinds of things. The question of the world of the vessel and the world of its contents emerges again and again. And in that context, in the 19th and the early 20th century, encounters with science. And going back to the 18th century, in fact, Simpukenpo in the 18th century, via the Jesuits and other diplomats and figures turning up between Tsarist Russia and the Qing courts, they're trying to account for contrasting scientific views or views arising from natural philosophy at the time about the physical world, about the human, about geography and demography and all these other sorts of things. My interest is these frontier exchanges in which the world of the contents and the world of the vessels is a particularly live and salient object of reflection. And that goes down right to the Tibetan exile community in the 1990s. I find folks like Tsimei Rinpoche trying to settle the debates about is the world round or is it not? And just making these appeals, not just which is the authoritative version of the world of the contents and the world of the vessel, but actually making a relativist argument that, in fact, all of these notions are valid. The Buddha himself is recorded as having described the world in multiple ways. What matters is the position from which we know the world. And in that way, you know, a NASA picture from the moon of the round earth can exist comfortably alongside an Abhidharma presentation or the Kalachakra presentation of a flat world or a square presentation of Mount Meru, the Axis Mundi at the center, or all the other kind of only apparently contradictory contradictions in Buddhist sources, which is what they're trying to account for. So somewhere in all that, I'm interested in an alternative and a refusal of the hegemony of nature culture and of the human as this already weighted sovereign subject, which I just think is not there. And that's a real opportunity to contribute to much wider conversations in the humanities from those of us in Buddhist studies.
Yeah, so you're, even though these concepts, these Buddhist terms, the world of the vessel, the world of the contents, have been around for a long time, you're really looking at this moment in history when Tibetans and Mongolians are using those terms to interact with European scientific traditions and try to make sense of and describe those from their own perspective in terms of how they taxonomize their objects of experience.
Yeah, which is absolutely.
Interesting, because often people will take the world of the vessel and the world of the contents as the correlate to nature and culture or nature and the human, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And, you know, especially when it comes to the early 20th century examples of those projects on the part of inner-Asian monks, we should be really careful of thinking of them as correlates, because those monks were writing amidst very complex social times in which science and as the hegemony of nature culture and social evolutionary models and Marxist models and so on were putting them on their heels. And so for those on the ground in those contexts, like, nature culture was not the world of the contents and the world of the vessel or whatever. These were competing, and these were basically being erased as part of a modernist project that ultimately ended in the sort of dismantling of these institutions and the suppression of the tradition. And for many of these prominent monks who were writing about such things, their imprisonment or death, actually. Mm. So, you know, there's sort of like a real politic almost to these debates as well, in the sense that these scholars were experiencing the arrival of a particular narrative of modernist progress in which they were erased, and in which was sort of operating on a model of universal notions of human progress and improvement, you know, whether it was filtered through the Soviet project or through a project in the PRC later on, and that Buddhist models of ways of knowing, their models of planetary thinking were set into a competing relationship, basically, and needed to be excluded, contained and excluded and suppressed. So I think it's great to account for that as well, and to try to think about what the conditions were in which these debates were being worked out.
Yes, exactly. Can you describe what you mean by planetary thinking?
I just mean accounts for something like fundamental relationships and causal relationships that entangle everything that one experiences from the point of view of these authors. So a total picture of the structures of worlds and how they may be known is my take on that. In other words, it's a universalist proposition that I like to use, because that's how scholars have described scientific modeling of the world. And I think it's great to put non-scientific traditions on equal footing in terms of the weight of their intellectual projects. And especially given that these models are being developed in exchange with competing planetary models, I like the idea of planetary thinking, because my interest, at least in the material, is not to reconstruct some planetary model or just describe what's in the text. I'm really interested in how these figures propose to know the world or the planetary authoritatively. And there's a cultural history of knowledge practices and of writing practices. And it also gestures to the problem with the nature-culture binary and the very weighted category of the human, capital H human, which is that is just another planetary proposition. These are not natural, already universal baselines upon which we know we can study the application of meaning and cultural interpretations. I mean, you know, just whatever we can do to give historical situatedness to these categories that underlie so much of the humanities and social science and the hard sciences too, and set them into place and time and in order to be critiqued and reimagined, I think is useful.
I want to ask you more about the idea of knowledge and environments being co-produced and fundamentally perspectival that you come to when you talk about these concepts, the world of the vessel and the world of the contents in a Tibetan or Mongolian context. Because I wonder if to say that knowledge and environment is co-produced and fundamentally perspectival, I wonder if you could explain more about what that means, because I to me it sounds like metaphysical idealism, by which I mean it focuses on the primacy of the mind in creating that kind of perspectival knowledge. And so then I wonder, how can we think about the agency or even the importance of non-sentient objects like rocks or water or deserts? And even if we might allow that plants might have sentience, still the focus on minds in the Buddhist sources you're looking at, doesn't it allow for still a kind of a humanist type of privileging of those who have minds?
Yeah, that's such a great question. Thank you so much. I think that actually what becomes a really interesting sort of response is that it is true that the Buddhist authors whose works I've been looking at would privileged mind in a way. Yeah, that definitely seems idealist in certain ways. But then we need, if we look at the mechanisms of knowing in which they discuss minds, actually we immediately get into these sort of, I mean, almost like a phenomenological sort of chain of knowledge, sensory organs, sensations, and environments in which knowledge as such is always situated and implanted and in a tangled relationship with a particular embodied sensory and environmental location, which is sort of the point. And of course, there is a karmic frame also. Karma, in a sense, is a way of talking about the particular embodied perspective from which you, me, ants, dogs, whales, gods, or whatever, interact with a cup of water or whatever. And the position in the sorts of canonical Indian Buddhist sources that these authors refer to most commonly when they're articulating these arguments are ones that really emphasize that environments are definable according to how they're experienced. The classic example of the 18 blind men and the elephant, you know, is an elephant the rough leg, the tail, is it a trunk, and all the rest? Or the classic one is that a human sees a cup of water, but a hungry ghost sees a cup of pus, and a fly sees its death, or a god sees it as nectar. So from that perspective, I mean, it's not idealist as such. It's really saying that environments are the ways in which we know them, which it kind of resonates with that Alexander von Humboldt notion of Ansichten der Natur. You know, Ansichten is like a where nature becomes like instrumentalized in a way. Nature is not an object of perception. It is a way of perceiving, in the sort of tangle of sensory access and perceiving minds and embodied experience and embodied situatedness and material context. I don't think that would register as idealist exactly. I think that it is more about questioning clear lines between objectivity and subjectivity, or seeing these as co-produced. And that's a really interesting starting point for these authors to encounter things like biomedicine, or, you know, Soviet state building projects, or secular science books in India that the Tibetan refugee community was needing to teach in monastic contexts, which is this other kind of part of this research I've been exploring of accounting for the Big Bang is actually a real big problem in some ways in 1970s and 80s refugee communities among certain authors, and as is the brain sciences, which is this whole other side of these kind of explorations I've been getting into lately. What I'm seeing is the position on the planetary as such, the position on the worlds of the vessel, worlds of the contents, that these are the perception and the ways of knowing and worlds thus known are already entangled and are co-produced, in fact, again, which gets outside of basic binaries between nature and culture in really fundamental ways.
Without privileging those who have minds, you think? Right. If you're thinking about rocks or water or a desert, and I know you mean many things by desert, and we can get to that, and maybe you mean just as many things by rocks or water, but in what sense can those non-sentient objects, the object without minds, have agency in an equivalent way?
Right. Well, so this is where it gets really interesting. There's two ways of answering that. One is following the sources, in which there is, in fact, extensive reflection I've been learning through following the lines of citation in these texts about materiality, about particles and atoms and their relationship to one another, their composition and aggregation. And also, Buddhists have tried to account for 25 centuries for the position that the mind is immaterial, yet can interact with and affect a material world. And so actually, Indian Buddhist records of old debates with materialists like the Charvakas and so on are a constant source of reference for these later monks who are interacting with, like, say, science, right till today. Actually, that becomes a strategy, a dialectic strategy. So it's great because you start following these accounts, which are coming from the Abhidharma, from medical texts, from the Kalachakra, from the Guhya Samaya Tantra on subtle bodies, especially like highest yoga tantra modelings of the human where subtle bodies are really like the most subtle material contact point between types of mind and winds and channels and all this stuff. Actually, there is a really great material account for mind's emplacement in a material world that also accounts for the composition of the material world in terms of things that are not included normally in the world of the contents, meaning sentient life primarily. You know, I might be overspeaking when I say that the world of the contents always refers to the sentient life, because also there's all kinds of discussions in those sources about mountain ranges and the oceans and the arising and falling away of the oceans. And actually a lot of discussion in that sense about what the Gobi is, specifically about the basin of a prehistoric ocean and all this kind of stuff. So I think that there is in the sources an account of materiality that's interesting. In my own positionality in thinking about the sources, this turn to the material and the affordances and the agencies of the material take on a real level of disciplinary importance that are not the same as what's in the sources. And specifically, I'm interested in the ways that monks and scientists and others in the 19th century began interacting with the Gobi in all kinds of ways, in terms of like unearthing and extracting the material geology of the Gobi and also of its artifacts, texts, statuary, bones, fossils, all those kinds of things. And so that's not really a topic that I've found of like extensive Buddhist philosophical reflection or anything. But the fact is that they were doing it and they were radically reimagining time because of interacting with the desert that way. And so in thinking about that scene and trying to think about that history of extraction and classification and dispossession, I'm interested in giving materiality its place and not simply an object of culture, but is actually helping to determine what is thinkable about history, specifically about deep history in all these different knowledge traditions, Buddhist scholasticism, geology, science, archaeology, Orientalism. So I have an interest in thinking about the sort of agency or the multivalency, the becoming with the material from a disciplinary perspective, and in terms of thinking about methods and questions in history, but then also really centering when those become topics of reflection in the sources.
I was thinking as you were speaking that it's such a deeply philosophical project in a way, especially when you're if you start looking back into European philosophy and the distinction between substance and non-substance, yeah. Or as you put it, mind and matter and materiality, just the very status of materiality in a European historical philosophical assumption. But then to move away from that, as you seem to always do in your work, to see what is another way to approach all the material, if we can drop our own assumptions as we read these materials, even the very assumption of what is a mind and what is matter. So it's both a very philosophical project, but then it's also embedded in this actual place at this actual time.
Well, I really appreciate that maybe is coming across a bit, only because that's really what's motivating me. I think that is the challenge to allow these sources to challenge our disciplinary practice, to demand a particular type of analytic kind of creativity and imagination. And I also think that's this moment in environmental humanities and medical humanities. That's this moment in what I like to position as sister disciplines to the type of critical Buddhist studies I'd love to see, which is like Black study, Indigenous studies, feminist criticism, decolonial, postcolonial scholarship, and all the rest, which are just trying to de-link from reproducing certain like West, non-West, universalist binaries that obscure and do not reveal our sources. And we should be challenged in our analysis. I really feel like that's the project. And I also really appreciate that there's a bit of a philosophical focus, because with the brain, you know, thinking about embodiment in brains and minds specifically, which is this sort of other project, I am really wanting that to be teachable in a philosophy classroom. And in fact, it's motivated by friends of mine in philosophy departments who are being challenged to expand the canon. So that's kind of what I'm interested in doing, and really charting also the frontiers of the brain sciences, which is what these Tibetan scholars are specifically responding to. And are leveraging centuries of Indic and Tibetan thought, logic, and epistemology to push back against the idea that electrons could move along nerves and somehow explain subjective conscious experience or whatever.
Yeah, I agree. That sounds amazing. It brings to mind a question that I had about something you wrote where you said a place to begin is in our pre-modern sources themselves, fonts of new methodological and analytical imagination. So I think as you're saying now, you were talking about sort of going back to these early texts and making them legible and things to think with creatively now. But then I also kind of wondered when you talk so much about critical Buddhist studies, if, you know, some people might say that overemphasis on pre-modern texts is precisely the problem with the academic study of Buddhism historically in the West. And so how do you reconcile this call to go back to these pre-modern sources and to textual sources with the other side of your work that I see looking at the desert and these material places and thinking of them as not only material places, but places of imagination and circulation and flows of experience and so on?
Yeah, I don't want to remain bonded to the perspectives of the text, but when I say a critical project, I'm responding to that long-standing and ongoing critique of Orientalist conceptual frameworks which underlie what Buddhist studies and Asian studies and all of its objects of analysis and its primary disciplinary program, which are so beholden to a West, non-West binary, by which I don't mean like an ethnic category. I mean as sort of the West as the site and source for universal knowledge and history, and even distinguishing between primary and secondary sources is a sort of like imperial act of erasure, actually, right? So there's a lot to say there, but I'm really responding to scholars like Wael Hallaq, for example, in Restating Orientalism, who says, we're not anywhere near done this work if we're simply naming ongoing obscuring conceptual frameworks of which religion is a prime culprit. And also Buddhism is a pluralist Orientalist imposition, right? So he says that what is at stake actually is the impulse to universal knowledge generally, to categories of universal knowledge about the human that are subjectifying expressions of modern power and therefore are linked fundamentally to forms of epistemic and political sovereignty that express themselves as genocide or slavery and imperialism some places, and otherwise appear as a troubled but persistent knowledge practice in our disciplines. I'm really motivated by scholars like Michel de Certeau, who say, look, the sources need to be able to bite back, right? In other words, they need to demand their own analysis. Interested in thinking about how our sources, their complexity will always exceed the knee-jerk disciplinary treatment we may want to apply to them and the categories and expectations we might have for them in the humanities and social sciences. And so a nature-culture binary is just a real basic one, right? Oh, there's nature, there's culture. Oh, there's religion somehow 1,000 years ago in a completely other culture and linguistic environment. That's a problem. And I think of colleagues in Islamic studies, right, who have been persistently pushing back on Christian-derived notions of religion as belief and models even of secularism as putatively universal, and starting with, why start with even belief? Why not start with the body? Why not start with movement? Why not start with things, material culture? Why not start with, I mean, your work's been looking at this in so many ways, of course. And so I guess I just am starting from the text. I want to emphasize how they cannot be accounted for and thinking about what is possible beyond that. In other words, I'm really interested in not just naming legacies of the Enlightenment and Oriental legacies, but doing the next thing, which I think we haven't done a lot of, which is like actually really radical acts of methodological experimentation, thinking about environments and landscapes and their agency and the constraints and affordances that they have imposed on the ways that these different communities were imagining deep history, especially in the 19th century in the Gobi.
What kinds of experiences in your training or personal experience have brought you to consider some of these questions? You did mention your experience in the desert. And so I'm imagining you physically being in the desert and having sand everywhere and that sort of embodied experience of that sensory experience. But I also know you to be a gardener and someone who spends a lot of time outside. And so I wonder if some of those sensory experiences influence your attraction and passion for these ideas you've been describing?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. Thank you so much. I think both of those are really, really important. And on a biographical level, yeah, as I think I said earlier, you know, just having had the pleasure and the really amazing opportunity to spend time in the Gobi, not as a tourist or driving through from my own removed distance perspective, but with people who live and know themselves to be part of that desert. That was very formative to me personally in all kinds of ways. Just that a few things come to mind. One is, I think your mind opens up a little bit when you're so helpless and in the hands of others, which I think is maybe a part of travel and maybe part of research or something it took me a long time to reflect on. Being really out there and there's no roads and there's no people. The Gobi is less populated or maybe second only to the Arctic, I think they say. And even though it's the size of like France or something, you know what I mean? Like, so there's nobody, there's no roads, there's no that. It's just camel tracks. And, you know, the experience of moving through the Gobi, even with people who are Gobi dwellers themselves, is to rely upon whoever you come across to know the way. And so just these memories of 3 a.m. knocking on the door with the driver of some nomadic family and this young man pulling a dell on, you know, a robe on and the pole to say like, yeah, you got to go that way to that mountain if you're trying to get to that river to that. And just the kindness extended in those networks. But specifically, like, not just being helpless, but thereby being also open to the ways that others were moving through the landscape. And that landscape was an interactive space, fundamentally, in all of my experiences with all these different people, from lamas and monks to just everyday drivers to kids or whatever, where it's like, oh, we're pulling over now, and now you stick your hand in this hole, and you pull out the rocks, and if there's more dark ones than white ones, then you're going to have a good summer, or that's a womb-like cave that we need to go crawl in and, you know, take your shirt off and rub your back. But also magical things like rocks out of nowhere where you pull over and you knock them and they ring like a bell. Or I swear I've seen this llama throwing offering scarves up into the air and it lands across the top of a mountain like 100 feet up. I watched it happen, you know what I mean? And like crawling into caves where meditators sat for generations and so on. So there's that kind of openness to that particular landscape as an outsider is just a big part of my own life story. That also through all that, I'll say, and I think this project was sort of hatched specifically in going on a trip with some UCLA people to Dunhuang a few years ago, to the Dunhuang Caves, and realizing like, oh, I'm in another corner sort of the Gobi, or if we have a bigger sort of definition of the Gobi or this desert network, and seeing this extractive hyper-nationalist project around Dunhuang and the extensions of PRC sovereignties through the Belt and Road Initiative and the history making and display of extracted objects and so on of the Gobi made me reflect on experiences I'd had elsewhere in the Gobi, you know, looking that way 1,000 miles or something across in these monasteries that had been revived in the Gobi after 70 years of socialist erasure and mass murder, actually, where all these hidden texts and objects and kettles and even boots and so on, which had been hidden very quickly before the army came by the monks, had been excavated. And now we're on the altars next to like Buddha statues and so on. These were like relics, ultimately, of a recovered past. And even the lamas I interacted with were often wearing clothing that had belonged to their predecessors 80 years earlier and had been buried. So like the excavated Gobi, its material presence was the thing that allowed a revival project to happen. Contrasting that logic of display with a PRC multimedia presentation about a 2,000-year benevolent extension of Chinese sovereignty over their Western frontier is an anachronistic, very troubling narrative. Just made me think, oh, there's just extraction upon extraction. And then looking into the ways that the Central Asiatic Expedition and all of these early Orientalists and geologists and archaeologists were all descending on the Gobi in the 19th and early 20th century. I guess my own experiences and my own small biographical story of extraction and community making and reparation and healing and knowledge making just all sort of started tumbling together. And then, again, reading like Catherine Yusoff's work, Black Anthropocene stuff, just which is all focused on extraction and classification and dispossession as basically a model of knowledge making and also a critique of knowledge making, made me think, oh, there's really need to just gather as many of those stories together as I could and think about the Gobi as a porous membrane across which things like time and community and relation are pulled through material interaction. Yeah, so anyways, the Gobi's a magical place has been for me, and I really don't want to be exotifying or anything. I'm just saying I've got to travel through there from my own removed perspective with people who have intimate interactive knowledge with those spaces and who were very kind and patient to allow me to trail along with them. Then it was just really amazing to see how they knew themselves through interacting with the landscape.
That's such a wonderful description and made me think that although you are a historian and you work primarily with texts in a sense, what you just described there was working with your body and your senses and your moving, sensing, experiencing emotional body.
Yeah. And
so that really comes through as the the tool that you are using in that work.
That's true. That's a really great observation. That's actually a very helpful one for me to think about maybe how to cobble together all these notes and ideas into some kind of narrative. And maybe I might recommend one thing on that point, which is a book that's really motivating me. It's called The Book of Unconformities by Hugh Raffles. For me, it's the most interesting piece of history or anthropology I've ever read. And it's really the scholar is telling great gigantic stories about human interactions with geology and particular materials like marble under Manhattan and, stones in Norway and even like, whale bodies, very elemental. And the ways that these were expanding grand models of history and of the modern and of moral tales and so on. But it's all rooted in particular objects and material things. And it's all rooted ultimately to his own way of grieving his sister's death in ways that are wildly intimate and one very rarely encounters in scholarship. But it's so fantastic. And it just is this artful masterwork on the ways that we know ourselves through interacting with particular things. And we craft grand narratives of our place through interacting with objects. And it's just full of 1,000 fascinating stories, of which his own is quite front and center. And I just thought, like, gosh, if I could ever write a book that somehow even is organized slightly that way, or is could it somehow begin to get towards that level of storytelling and of analysis, I'd be so happy. And I'm kind of wanting this Gobi project to be like a literary experiment, and which is to say kind of organizing the story, the analysis. And I guess that would involve me also thinking about my own movement and spaces and sensory encounters as one part of the story.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. I'll check that book out for sure. I'll share in turn. Do you know David Abrams' The Spell of the Sensuous?
I do, and I read that book all the time. I love that book so much.
Yeah.
I actually take that book every time I go to the beach and I read the introduction again. I think it is such a great book, so different and interesting.
Yeah, he's got that chapter on shadows, and you talk about shadows a few times, I've heard, in this conversation and your work on the Gobi, and I thought of that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I should go back and read that chapter.
Shadows being not just absences or not being two-dimensional, but being sort of alive with dimensional experience.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, I should really go back and look at that. That's a great part of that book.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all your thoughts. That was so fascinating, and I can't wait to read everything that comes forth from your eloquent pen.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
This episode of Buddhist Studies Footnotes was created, produced, and edited by me, Frances Garrett, with support from the Robert H. N. Ho Family Foundation Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Toronto. This project aims to make Buddhist studies research freely available to students and the public.